there's no other private school for refugees in the world. And I don't think it's coincidental that it exists in the United States. And not only in the United States, it got its start in the South.
Here's a story that you don't hear every day. A gay Arab Muslim immigrant finds her new home is deep in the heart of Dixie. She moves to Atlanta, where she launches a school out of a basement that's now teaching 90 different kids from 20 different ethnic backgrounds. And all of it is supported by mom-and-pop donors spread across the U.S., people chipping in 20 or 40 bucks wherever they can.
There's so many good people that we've met there that are so excited about us. I mean, people are always shocked how we're, you know, we're running our school in Georgia. And yeah, we're running in Georgia. And we're having a great time doing it.
The woman's name is Luma Mufla. She's a soccer coach who founded a school called Fuji's Academy, which educates the children of refugee families. Refugees has become one of these hot-button words in recent years. It almost feels like you're inviting controversy just by saying it. But Luma says that the fiery debates you see in the mainstream media obscure reality.
This wouldn't be possible without the generosity and support of people all around the country. I mean, I'm not saying that we don't experience hostility. We've gotten called names on the field. We've been told to go back to our countries. I had someone like leave messages on the phone telling me they're sending me back to Saudi Arabia. I don't even understand the connection to Saudi Arabia.
Luma is actually from Jordan, not from Saudi Arabia, but it's not like hecklers pay attention to those sort of details.
We had a girl, she was playing on the boys' team, and a boy from an opposing team made some derogatory remarks towards her and called her a terrorist and told her to go back where she came from. And that was her first time hearing it, and she, you know, I could feel her tense up on the field, and I pulled her off and talked to her about it and then made her go shake his hand. And I said, you will not stoop to his level. He wants you to get angry. He wants you to yell. You don't change who you are because that's what he wants you to do. And so she shook his hand, and then he came up to her right after and apologized. We do that all the time. We don't always have the apology at the end. We don't always change people's minds, but I think especially through sport, it's an opportunity to get people to change their perspective. Because if you're a parent and you see kids out there playing, like, that's what it's about. It's about kids playing. It's about kids learning. Working with kids is not a political issue, and it should not be turned into one.
If competition or politics can sometimes bring out the worst in people, then stories like Fuji's Academy shows people at their best. In fact, it might be the world's greatest illustration of a multicultural society gone right. Inside the school, you'll see that there are kids of every race and religion learning tolerance and acceptance. Outside, you have donors who make it all possible, and behind it all, you have Luma, an unlikely hero who saw children in need and took action to help. This is Crazy Good Turns. We tell inspiring stories about people who do amazing things for others, and I'm your host, Brian Sabin. Luma's life is really three refugee stories rolled into one. First, there's her upbringing. Luma grew up in Jordan, but her mother's family is from Syria. Her grandparents fled that country when the first Assad regime came to power.
In 1964, when the Assad regime first took power in Syria, and they took over my grandfather's factories and tortured his brothers, and so my family fled to Jordan. They started from scratch, and so that story was always important to us.
The family flourished in their new country. Both sets of her grandparents became self-made millionaires, and Luma grew up with what she describes as a life of privilege. But her grandmother, Munawar, never let the family forget their heritage. When Luma turned 8 years old, Munawar took her to a camp to visit Syrian refugees for the first time.
She had taken, you know, every single one of the grandchildren as they hit a certain age. And so it was my turn, and I didn't want to go because I didn't feel I had anything to share with anyone in a refugee camp. I thought they were beneath me. And she took me there, and she's like, go and play. And I was like, I don't want to play. Very firm, very loving, but very firm. And she's like, go and play with them and don't come back until you've played. And so I went and played, and the common language there was soccer. And we had an incredible time, and she sat and visited with the women like she always does. And then when we got ready to leave, you know, I was like really happy and that I got to play with these kids. And you know, I made a comment saying haram, which means poor them. And it upset my grandmother. She's like, haram is on us. And she used the words different meaning, that we were sinning, that we shouldn't feel sorry for them, but we should believe in them, that we shouldn't do something to make ourselves feel good and then do nothing about a bigger problem that we face every day.
From that day on, Luma visited the camps regularly. Meanwhile, she attended Western schools. Her parents believed that was the best that the world had to offer, so Luma learned to speak English at a young age. She also grew up as an athlete. Luma discovered soccer at a young age and flourished in the sport, partly through the coaching of an American diplomat. Luma moved to the United States to attend college on a soccer scholarship. She later changed schools and graduated from Smith College in Massachusetts. That's where her second refugee story begins.
I attended Smith College in Massachusetts, loved it, made great friends, and my senior year I applied for political asylum.
Why political asylum at that time?
Because in a lot of in different parts of the world, including Jordan, you can get the death penalty for being gay. And so I knew I didn't really have much of a choice.
Even though Luma felt it was her only choice, the decision was not easy, and it came at great cost. By requesting asylum, she had to renounce her Jordanian citizenship. The choice also drove a rift between Luma and her parents, who disinherited her. Just after graduation, living in an unfamiliar country, Luma was really, truly on her own.
The people that welcomed me here 20 years ago, like I never would have been able to do it on my own if I didn't feel like people cared for me. And so that's why I think I can connect with these kids, is because I've had a similar journey of having to leave my home. My family has had to leave their country. And so it's that cultural brokerage role that I get to play with them.
After college, Luma spent a few years trying to get on her feet. She held a job in Boston for a while, then moved down to North Carolina, where a friend's family owned a restaurant.
One of my close friends, one of my classmates' friend's aunt owned a restaurant in Highlands, North Carolina. All my friends had worked there at some point or another. She was always looking for help. And so I asked if I could go and work at her restaurant. She always needed help. And my friends were really skeptical because Miss Sarah is a Southern Baptist. And here I was, a gay Arab Muslim going up to the mountains of North Carolina. And like, did I really think this through? And it was one of the best parts of that time in my life, because I felt I finally had a home. Miss Sarah welcomed me into her house, gave me a job, had me starting off washing dishes. And it was a very humbling experience, washing dishes and cleaning restrooms for months, and then gradually moving me up to cook and then waiting tables. I never did manage the restaurant, but she believed in hard work and taking care of each other and Southern hospitality. And I celebrated Christmas with her family. And, you know, she attempted to fast during Ramadan, but that was a little hard for her.
Within a few years, Luma had gotten the entrepreneurial itch. 3 days before her 24th birthday, she bid Miss Sarah farewell, moved down to Atlanta, and launched a cafe of her own. Her shop broke even at first and provided Luma with enough to live on. She found enough free time to volunteer as a soccer coach. But then, a wrong turn led her to the third refugee story of her life.
I drive to Clarkson to get authentic Middle Eastern food. They had a Middle Eastern grocery store that I drove to quite regularly, and I would literally go into the grocery store and leave. And one day I missed my turn onto Ponce de Leon and ended up going down Indian Creek. And, you know, I pass a mosque, I pass a Buddhist temple, and it was a part of Clarkston I had never driven through.
It's worth pausing here to explain some things about Clarkston. It's a small town located a little less than 13 miles east of downtown Atlanta. The city became a refugee resettlement hub in the 1980s, starting with Vietnamese and Cambodian refugees escaping communism. As more conflicts emerged around the globe, Bosnia, Kosovo, Congo, Sudan, Afghanistan, Syria, more people from more cultures arrived in Clarkston. Today, more than 46% of the city's residents are foreign-born. Anyway, back to Luma.
And then I U-turn into this apartment complex to try and get back to where I'm supposed to be headed, and I see these kids outside playing soccer. And they were playing with a raggedy soccer ball and rocks set up as goals, and they were barefoot. And it reminded me of home. It reminded me of the way I grew up playing soccer in the streets of Jordan with my brothers and cousins, of playing soccer with the kids at the refugee camp in Jordan. And so I stayed and watched. And then at that time, I was volunteer coaching at the YMCA. So I had a bunch of soccer balls in my trunk. And so I grabbed one, wanting to play with them. They were skeptical about letting a woman and a stranger play, but they really wanted the newer soccer ball. They reluctantly, you know, after they got in their little huddle, decided and reluctantly let me in on their game. And that was the start of it.
This sort of encounter became a regular thing. Luma started spending more time away from her business to be at the field with the refugee kids.
So I just kept making excuses to leave work, to run errands, to play with them, and eventually got to know the kids and wanted to know if they wanted to start a soccer team. So I formed one team, and then siblings of the kids would come and they'd want their own team. And so we ended up, by the second year, having three soccer teams going.
The first team formed in 2004. Under Luma's coaching, the teams were very competitive. The athletes had a lot of talent. But Luma soon realized that the kids had more needs than she could meet on the pitch alone.
There were a couple of times kids would ask me to help them with their homework, and initially I was dismissive. I was like, go ask your parents or your siblings to help you, not realizing that their parents were illiterate in their own language. And so I was like, well, if these were my kids, what would I do? I said, okay, if this was my kid, I would put them in a private school that could meet their needs. I couldn't afford a private school, so it was a lot cheaper to start a private school. So started with six kids back in 2007, and then grew every year.
Fuji's Academy began in a basement of a church in Decatur, Georgia. And to see how their curriculum is different from that of a traditional school, it's helpful to understand the main issue it addresses. Here's what happens when a refugee enters most schools. They are placed in a grade that's appropriate based on their age, but not on their level of ability. So the kids often find themselves in way over their heads.
So 11, 12-year-old who has never spent a day in school in their life is placed in the 6th or 7th grade, and they're expected to function. I had met a couple of kids that had been in the public school system for 4 years, could speak English relatively well, but could not read a word.
Fuji's takes a different approach. Students start at the beginning, the very beginning. At the school, sixth graders learn the fundamentals of language, the sort of stuff you might see in an episode of Daniel Tiger. They work upward from there.
Our middle school is really unique because we start at the kindergarten level. So in sixth grade, they're learning, you know, letters of the alphabet, colors, days of the week, seasons of the year, and then working our way up. You can't start them at sixth grade level if they don't know their alphabet. And same with math. Our kids are learning how to count, how to add, how to subtract, and how to multiply. And our classes are small. So we have 14 kids in a classroom, and they tend to advance a lot more rapidly. You know, we create an environment where kids really want to learn and are empowered to learn and are also empowered to fail. There's no shame in failing or struggling. We create a culture where kids ask for help and get the help that they need. In 3 years, we've caught them up to grade level.
The Fuji's Academy students we spoke with said this approach was hugely helpful. Most schools skipped over these most basic of basics. The students felt that they had been struggling to keep up as a result. For example, we spoke with one Fuji's graduate named Baba Jaden. Baba's family is from South Sudan. They then fled to Ethiopia and finally received refugee status here in the U.S. During his first few years here, he was unable to read or write, but traditional schools passed him on from grade to grade.
When I first came to the Fuji's Academy, I did not speak much English at all, nor did I know how to write or read or do math or anything like that, because the school I went to previously did little to help me with that subjects. And when I came to the Fuji's, it was start out from the beginning, like a kindergartner would, and learn how to read, write, and just keep building up until I could actually do all those things on my own.
Not only did Baba learn to read and write, but literature became his favorite subject.
I liked the literature class reading because I really liked reading, and reading is one of the things that I actually started to pick up when I was at the Fuji's Academy, because it kind of takes me away from all the things that are happening around me. Sometimes just let my mind dive into a book and go from there.
Today, books are a welcome escape from Baba's classes at Elms College in Massachusetts, where he's studying to become a computer scientist. He's also an athlete on the school soccer team, where he earned a starting spot as a freshman. Sports, and soccer specifically, are also important at Fuji's Academy. A day at Fuji's Academy is meant to be demanding both mentally and physically. The school day starts at 7:30 a.m., when kids spend the first 30 minutes of the day performing yoga or some other physical activity.
We work with 6th through 12th grade, so 11 to 19-year-olds. They need a physical outlet, and so we added this 2 years ago, starting off the day with yoga, and it's really helped a lot with their focus and getting kids ready for the day, and we end with physical activity.
Following their morning workout, the kids are in classes just like at any other school, math, music, social studies, English, you name it. Luma describes the school's model as military meets Montessori.
So I think military and Montessori have a lot of crossover. You know, they're very big on culture. They're very big on community. And they're also very big on self-reliance. Montessori is like you meet the kid where they're at and you give them the tools to succeed. Military has a lot of structure and routine around it. And we're kind of a blend of both. We understand that not all kids learn the same way. Not all kids are at the same place. And so we meet them, but we give them the tools. We don't do the work for them. We don't make excuses for them. It's very much a tough love approach.
The school day ends at 3:30, when there's a short break until 4 p.m. Then it's time for practice. All 90 of Fuji's Academy students play on one of the school's soccer teams.
So we field 7 soccer teams. And in addition to that, we field 2 varsity soccer teams and 2 varsity cross-country teams. So the varsity teams are tryout teams, but everybody else plays on rec teams.
The school also has a cross-country team, which has won Georgia state titles in each of the past 2 years. These sports aren't just a physical outlet. They help the students develop a sense of community.
When you know you have a team of kids that have your back no matter what, on and off the field, it's really powerful to someone who feels isolated and like they don't belong.
After practice, there are tutoring sessions for the kids to attend. Most head home somewhere around 7 p.m., late, but often necessary, since many of their parents work very long hours. In fact, Luma says that many of the parents work in chicken processing plants in Gainesville, Georgia, which is located about 2 hours away.
There's vans that shuttle the parents up. So we'd have a parent that's starting the 6 o'clock shift or 7 o'clock shift would leave home at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, having, you know, prepared food and dinner for their kids because they're not going to be back home for dinner. And they go to the chicken processing plant and they work in generally refrigerated conditions and they're standing up all day and they're slicing meat or moving boxes. And they do that every single day. It's jobs most of us wouldn't even consider.
Throughout the year, Fuji's Academy observes every religious holiday from every major religion. They use those times as opportunities to teach the kids about different cultures.
And so like at our school, we celebrate everything from Christmas to Eid to Holi to the Buddhist New Year to 4th of July and Thanksgiving. And we teach around those. We get the kids to understand what those holidays are about. For example, for Eid, you know, we'll talk about it's the end of Ramadan, and so this is why we're celebrating Eid. This is why we talk about the story of Abraham being asked to sacrifice his son for God. And you'll see a lot of the Christian kids in particular be like, oh, we know that story. And then the Muslim kids get to bring food and share it with all the other kids and get to explain it. I think what was a beautiful moment this year on the first day of Ramadan, about 30% of our student population is Muslim, but we had an additional like 15 to 20 kids and staff fasting as well in solidarity. For Holi, the Hindu holiday, it's a color festival. So that was more a playful day of everybody going outside and splashing each other with different colors. And then the Nepali students bought traditional desserts and shared the history of that holiday with us.
By every imaginable measurement, the Fuji's Academy approach is working. To date, the school has a 100% graduation rate, and all of those kids have went on to attend college, which is why the school is growing and expanding into new cities across the U.S.
All of them are the first in their families to not only go on to college, but about 85% of them are the first in their families to finish 8th grade. People really want us to replicate our model and do it in other parts of the country. So this fall, we're opening our second school in Columbus, Ohio, and we're welcoming 56 students. And the year after, we're opening in Cleveland, Ohio.
Why those locations?
For me personally, like I wanted to go into the heartland. I think a lot of people focus on the coast. Like, yeah, we're going to do something in California or New York or Boston. And nobody really focuses on Middle America. And I think that's where the innovation needs to go. And that's where it will grow, especially social innovation.
Why do you think that?
I think it's hungry for it. There's so many good people that we've met there that are so excited about us. I mean, people are always shocked how we're running our school in Georgia. And yeah, we're running in Georgia. We're having a great time doing it. And now I get to do it in Ohio and then Indiana and then Missouri. And hopefully a Fuji's Academy in every big city that resettles refugees.
In all of these communities, Luma's goal isn't just to teach refugees. It's to teach people everywhere that the word refugee isn't something to be ashamed of or pitied or feared. Last year, she delivered a TED Talk titled, Don't Feel Sorry for Refugees, Believe in Them.
I gave my TED Talk last year, and I was really nervous about showing it to my students because it was the first time I'd shared any part of my identity with them publicly, like especially the story of my grandmother and being a refugee. And right after the talk, at the end of the day, one of my students, who's quiet and usually cynical, and he came up to me and he said, Coach, today you made me proud to be a refugee. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of our podcast. Go to crazygoodturns.org to learn more about Fuji's Academy. We'll also have a link there where you can donate. You can submit your ideas for people or organizations we should feature on an upcoming episode by emailing us at hello@crazygoodturns.org. Stay connected with us between shows by following us on Facebook and Twitter at @crazygoodturns. Our show is audio engineered by Stephen Keith. Music supervision and mixing provided by Score in Los Angeles. Special thanks to Megan Basinger, and I'm your host, Brian Sabin.
Get to know people. Welcome them. Learn about their traditions. Teach them about your traditions. Like, I remember going to church with Miss Sarah and doing Christmas celebration, and I loved it. I loved learning about her faith and learning about the South, eating buttermilk pie for the first time. And I think we need to do more of that. We need to have those relationships.